am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Welcome back. I am glad you are here. I am always glad when you come back, when you set aside the noise of the day and sit with me for a little while. It means something to me, more than you probably know. Last time we walked together through the streets of medieval Persia with a physician named Abu Bakr al-Razi, Razes, as the West came to call him, a man who trusted his own careful eyes more than inherited opinion, who looked at a sick child and thought, what is actually happening here? He paid a price for that kind of independence. They usually do. Today we are moving, across centuries and cultures, to a cold Swiss city in the early 16th century, to Zurich, in the years when Europe was tearing itself apart and putting itself back together all at once. The Reformation was young and loud and full of itself, as revolutions tend to be. And in the middle of all that noise, a young man, barely 30, not particularly saintly, honestly a bit of a troublemaker in his student years, asked a question that turned out to be one of the most important questions of the modern world. Not what should we believe, but who has the right to tell us? His name was Conrad Grebel, and I was there. I want to take you somewhere specific. January 21st, 1525, Zurich, Switzerland. It is winter, and the city is cold in that particular way that stone cities are cold, the chill coming up through the floor, seeping through the walls, settling into your bones before you have even noticed it arriving. The house belongs to a man named Felix Manns. It is not a large house. The men gathered inside it are not large men, not in the way the world measures largeness. No titles among them worth mentioning, no armies, no official seals. Just a small group of believers, hunched together by candlelight, doing something the city council had explicitly forbidden them to do. Simply meeting. I was there, though no one saw me. I have been in rooms like that before. Small rooms where something large was quietly beginning. You learn to recognize them. There is a particular quality to the air. Conrad Grebel was there. Felix Manns, whose house it was. A former priest named George Blaurock, broad-shouldered and intense, who had walked away from everything he had known because he could not make his conscience fit the shape the church required. They prayed, they talked. And then Blaurock did something simple, and in that moment, extraordinary. He asked Conrad Grebel to baptize him. Not because the council had authorized it, not because a bishop had sanctioned it, but because he was a grown man, making a free choice in the full knowledge of what that choice would cost. Grebel baptized him, with water, with a word, quietly, in a cold room, in a city that would have arrested every person present if it had known what was happening inside. Afterward, Blaurock baptized the others. That was all. No thunder, no proclamation, just water and conscience and a handful of people deciding together that the boundary between their inner life and the reach of civil power was worth defending. I have thought about that room many times since. Felix Manns was drowned in the Limmat River 2 years later, the city council's sentence. The same water. A very different intention. I will come back to that. Conrad Grebel was not supposed to be a revolutionary. He was born around 1498 into one of Zurich's most prominent families. His father, Jakob, was a magistrate, a merchant, a man of standing, the kind of father who pulls strings and opens doors. And he pulled them for Conrad. A stipend from the emperor to study in Vienna. A scholarship from the King of France to study in Paris, 3 universities across 6 years. The best humanist education money and connections could buy. Conrad did not make the most of it. I watched him in Paris, and I will be honest with you. He was not, in those years, a young man who suggested greatness. He was bright, certainly. Restless. Argumentative. He got into brawls. He spent money he didn't have. He lived loosely as young men with too much freedom and not enough purpose sometimes do. His father eventually cut off his funds and called him home in something close to disgrace. He came back to Zurich around 1520, no degree, damaged reputation, poor health. And then something happened that I have seen happen to people before in many centuries and many cities. He met an idea that was bigger than he was, and it changed him. The idea came through a man named Huldrych Zwingli, the great reformer of Zurich, preaching at the Grossmünster. that enormous cathedral that still stands at the heart of the city today. Zwingli was brilliant and bold, and Grable was drawn to him immediately. He joined a small study circle, Greek classics, the Latin Bible, the Hebrew scriptures, the Greek New Testament. He met Felix Manns there, a scholar's son, quiet and precise. Two young men on fire with the same questions. By 1522, something in Grable had shifted completely. His friends noticed it. His family noticed it. He married a woman named Barbara against his family's wishes, a choice that cost him at home, but seemed not to trouble him at all. He had found his footing. He was done drifting. For a time, he was Zwingli's most enthusiastic follower. But enthusiasm has a way of revealing the distance between what a teacher says and what a teacher does. In October 1523, the second disputation in Zurich addressed the Mass and the removal of images from the church. Zwingli argued brilliantly for reform, and then, when he saw the city council was not yet ready, he stepped back. He would wait. He would work within the system. He would not break with the council that gave his reforms their protection. Grable watched this and felt something harden in him. It was not that he thought Zwingli a coward exactly. It was something more precise than that. He saw in that moment the fault line that would define the rest of his short life, the place where the Reformation, still young and loud and full of promise, was already making its peace with power, already letting the magistrates set the pace of God. The break came fully over baptism. January 17, 1525, a public debate, Zwingli on one side, Grable and Manns, and Blaurock on the other. The question, must infants be baptized? The city council ruled in favor of Zwingli. All unbaptized infants were to be brought for baptism within 8 days. The Grable group was ordered to cease their activities. Failure to comply meant exile. Grable had an infant daughter named Isabella. He had not baptized her. He did not intend to. 4 days later, he was in Felix Manns' house, in the cold and the candlelight, doing something that was already illegal. I want you to understand what was actually at stake in that room. It was not at its heart about water. I have watched human beings argue about ritual for a very long time, about the right words, the right gestures, the right moment, the right vessel. And I have learned to listen underneath those arguments, because the ritual question is almost never the real question. The real question is always something older and more dangerous. The real question in Felix Manns' house that January night was this: who has authority over your soul? Zwingli's answer and the city council's answer were, whether they admitted it or not, the same answer. The church sets the doctrine. The state enforces it. An infant must be baptized because the church requires it and the magistrate commands it. Your conscience in this matter is not yours to keep. It belongs to the community, to the institution, to the civic order that holds everything together. Grable's answer was different, and it was precise. He was not saying the council had no authority. He was not an anarchist. I want to be clear about that. He understood that magistrates have a proper role, that civic order is a real and necessary thing, that authority itself is not the enemy. What he was saying was that authority has boundaries. The city council has authority over the city. It can set tax rates and settle disputes and keep the peace. What it cannot do, what no earthly power can legitimately do, is reach inside a person's conscience and command what must be found there. The moment the state begins ruling on the contents of your inner life, it has crossed a line that no council chamber was ever meant to cross. And the church, Zwingli's church, the Reformed church that had just liberated itself from Rome, was using the council's sword to enforce its own doctrine. It had traded one entanglement for another. The Pope's authority had been rejected, the magistrate's authority had been embraced, the address had changed, the arrangement had not. Grable and his friends were proposing something that sounds simple and is actually radical: that a person's faith must be freely chosen, or it is not faith at all, that a church composed of people who are there because they want to be there, because they have examined their conscience and made a voluntary commitment, is a fundamentally different thing from a church you are born into because the state requires it. One is a community, the other is a census category. This is what the baptism of adults meant. Not merely a different theology of sacrament, a different understanding of what a human being is. A soul with dignity. A conscience that belongs to itself, a person who can stand before God and before the magistrate and say, "This is mine, and you cannot have it." They paid for that position. Felix Manns was arrested, tried, condemned. On January 5, 1527, barely 2 years after that quiet gathering in his own house, he was bound, taken to the Limot River, and drowned. The city council's sentence, Zwingli's endorsement. I was there for that, too. I have stood at the edge of many rivers in my long life and watched many things I did not want to see. What I remember most about that day is not the violence of it, though it was violent, but the particular cruelty of the choice of method. He who dips shall be dipped. The authorities called it justice. I have another word for it. It was the answer of power that has forgotten where its authority ends. When a council must drown a man in a river to settle a question of conscience, it has already lost the argument. It simply does not know it yet. Conrad Grebel did not live to see it. He was gone by then, dead of plague in the summer of 1526, barely 28 years old, worn through by imprisonment and flight and the relentless cost of holding a position that the world had decided it could not tolerate. He had been an Anabaptist for exactly 18 months. 18 months. I keep coming back to that. The entire arc of Conrad Grebel's active life as an Anabaptist, from that cold room in January 1525 to his death in the summer of 1526, fits inside a year and a half. He was not a systematic theologian. He left no great treatise, 69 letters, a few poems, fragments of a pamphlet that survived only because Zwingli quoted it in order to argue against it. And yet, what Grebel and that small illegal gathering planted in the world was one of the most consequential ideas in the history of human freedom. Not because they intended to change civilization. They intended to be faithful, which is a different thing entirely. But because the idea they were defending had a life of its own, and it would not stay in Zurich. The idea was this: the church and the state are different things, with different purposes and different boundaries, and the health of both depends on keeping them that way. This sounds obvious to modern ears. It is so woven into the fabric of democratic society that we barely notice it is there, like a load-bearing wall you walk past every day without thinking about what it holds up. But in 1525, it was not obvious at all. It was dangerous. It was, by the standards of nearly every authority in Europe, heretical. For 1,000 years, the church and the civil order had been understood as two expressions of a single Christian society. The emperor and the pope might quarrel over who outranked whom, but they agreed on the basic architecture. You were born into Christendom the way you were born into a family, not by choice, but by arrival. The idea that a person might step outside that structure and form a voluntary community of conscience was not just theologically eccentric, it was socially explosive. It threatened the entire order. Grebel understood this. He understood it clearly enough to write to Thomas Müntzer, the radical reformer in Germany who was moving toward armed uprising, and urge him not to take up the sword. Even then, in the earliest months of the movement, Grebel saw the connection that I have been thinking about ever since. Violence is the symptom of authority that has lost its sense of its own limits. Müntzer believed that God's kingdom had to be seized, that the sword was the instrument of reform. Grebel believed the opposite, that the moment you pick up the sword, you have accepted the logic of the system you are trying to leave. You have decided that coercion is a legitimate tool of conscience. And once you decide that, you are no longer in a different place than your oppressors. You are simply the next person holding the weapon. The non-resistance of the early Anabaptists was not passivity. I want to be clear about that. These were not people who did not care. They preached constantly, traveled ceaselessly, rebuilt their communities every time they were scattered, and died in remarkable numbers without recanting. What they refused was the particular logic that says power justifies itself through force. They stepped outside the system of state-sanctioned violence, and in doing so, they also stepped outside the system of state-sanctioned faith. The two things were always connected. They still are. Now, I need to say something carefully here, because I have watched this pattern across many centuries and many civilizations, and it matters. The idea of separating church and state, of protecting conscience from coercion, is genuinely liberating. It is one of the great gifts of the Anabaptist tradition to the modern world. The Mennonites carry it. The Baptists carry it. The Quakers found their own path to the same clearing. The Free Church tradition in all its variations flows from that cold room in Zurich. But a gift can be counterfeited. I have seen it happen before. The language of freedom picked up and run backwards. The boundary that was built to protect the vulnerable from the powerful turned around and used to protect the powerful from accountability. The wall that was meant to keep the state out of the church reinterpreted to mean the church should have no obligations to the civic order it inhabits. The conscience that Grebel defended as a private sanctuary, weaponized as a public exemption. When the language of religious freedom is used to justify discrimination, when the machinery of the state is recruited to enforce one community's preferences over another's in the public square, that is not what Grebel meant. That is not what he died for, or what Felix Manns drowned for, or what those 18 months of relentless, costly, unglamorous faithfulness was about. What they were doing was drawing a line, quietly, at personal cost, in the right direction. The wolf, as I have had occasion to observe across a very long life, does not always arrive looking like a wolf. Sometimes it arrives speaking the language of the very freedom it means to dissolve. And that is when you need to remember what the original argument actually was, who it protected, and from what and why. Grebel knew. He was 26 years old, cold, exhausted, and completely clear. I want to speak to you plainly now, more plainly than I usually do. I have been alive a very long time. I have watched empires build themselves up on the strength of a single luminous idea, and I have watched those same empires hollow that idea out from the inside slowly, carefully, using the language of the idea itself to do the hollowing. I have seen it enough times to recognize the early signs. The particular quality of the light before a storm. I am seeing it now. The boundary that Conrad Grebel defended with his freedom and that Felix Manns defended with his life is the boundary between the authority of the state and the authority of conscience. Keep those two things in their proper relationship, and something like human dignity becomes possible. Collapse them together, and you get the Zurich City Council deciding who must be baptized. You get a magistrate setting the terms of your inner life. You get water used as a weapon. That boundary did not build itself. It was built by people like Grebel, ordinary, imperfect, complicated people who saw something clearly and refused to unsee it, even when the cost was everything. And it can be unbuilt. That is what I need you to understand. It does not come apart all at once. It never does. It comes apart in arguments that sound reasonable, in legislation that uses the word freedom in every sentence, in court decisions that position the powerful as the persecuted, that take the machinery built to protect the vulnerable and run it quietly in reverse. It comes apart when the language of conscience is used not to protect the individual from the state, but to recruit the state into the service of a particular community's preferences, and call that recruitment liberty. I have watched this move before. I know its rhythm. It begins with grievance, real or manufactured. It finds the vocabulary of the oppressed and puts it in the mouths of the powerful. It wraps itself in the flag of the very tradition it is dismantling. And it is patient. It does not need to win everything at once. It just needs to blur the line, to make people uncertain about where the boundary was or whether it ever really mattered. Grebel was 26 years old, and he was not uncertain. Not for a moment. He understood that the separation of these two domains, the civil and the spiritual, was not a threat to faith. It was the condition that makes genuine faith possible. A belief you hold because the state requires it is not a belief. It is compliance. A church that needs the magistrate's sword to fill its pews is not confident in its own truth. It is afraid of what happens when the sword is put down. Real faith does not need the apparatus of civil power. It stands on its own, or it examines itself until it can. And here is the other thing Grebel knew, the thing I watched him write in that letter to Münzer all those years ago in 1524. The moment you pick up the sword to defend the truth, you have already compromised it. Violence is not a tool of conscience. It is the signature of authority that has forgotten where it ends. I am not without hope. I want to be clear about that. I have walked this earth long enough to know that the arc of the human story bends, slowly, unevenly, with tremendous cost and heartbreak along the way, towards something better. I have seen ideas that were whispered in illegal rooms become the foundation of constitutions. I have seen the line that Greble drew in a cold house in Zurich become centuries later the first words of a Bill of Rights. I have seen the tradition of non-resistance he planted grow into movements that brought down empires without firing a single shot. The future I glimpse from where I stand is real. It is worth walking toward. It is more connected, more just, more conscious of the dignity of every single soul than anything that has come before it. But you do not get there with your eyes closed. You get there by knowing what the line is and why it was drawn. By recognizing the wolf when it arrives, speaking the language of the sheep. By understanding that freedom of conscience was never meant to be a weapon. It was meant to be a shelter. For everyone. Especially for the ones the powerful would prefer to silence. Greble built that shelter in 18 months with nothing but conviction and water and a willingness to pay whatever the position cost him. The least we can do is remember what it was for. I want to ask you something, and I want you to sit with it for a moment before you answer, even if the answer only ever exists inside your own quiet mind. Have you ever felt the pressure to comply? Not the dramatic kind, not the magistrate at the door, not the threat of exile or worse. I mean the quieter kind. The pressure that comes from a community, a workplace, a family, an institution that has decided what you should think, what you should say, what you should be, and has made it clear in ways both spoken and unspoken that deviation will cost you something. Most of us have felt it. It is one of the oldest human experiences there is, and most of us, if we are honest, have complied at least some of the time. Not out of cowardice exactly, out of exhaustion, out of love for the people around us, out of a reasonable calculation about what battles are worth fighting and what peace is worth keeping. I understand that. I do not judge it. But Greble's story asks a harder question underneath that one. Not have you ever complied, but do you know where your line is? Do you know which part of your inner life is yours alone? The part that no institution, no majority, no authority with a seal and a sword can legitimately claim? Because that part exists. It has always existed. It is the most important thing about you. It is also the thing that requires the most tending. It can be worn down by pressure, gradually, so slowly you don't notice it happening until one day you look inside and find that you have outsourced your conscience to someone else entirely. To a political movement, a religious institution, a cultural tribe. And you are no longer sure what you actually believe, as opposed to what you have been told to believe. Greble tended that space fiercely. At 26, with an infant daughter he refused to have baptized not because he was stubborn, but because he was clear. He knew the difference between what the council required and what his conscience held. He kept them separate. He paid the price of keeping them separate. I am not asking you to be a martyr. The world has enough of those, and most of them did not choose the role. I am asking something smaller and more daily than that. I am asking you to know where the line is, to notice when someone is trying to move it, to recognize the difference between authority operating within its proper sphere and authority that has wandered outside it, whether that authority comes from a government, a church, a corporation, a social movement, or the quiet, relentless pressure of people you love who need you to agree with them. And when you find that pressure arriving at the boundary of your own conscience, that place that is yours, that no one gave you and no one can take, I hope you will do what that young man did in the cold, in the candlelight, in a room full of people who had decided that some things are worth the cost. Hold the line. Gently, if you can. Firmly, always. Next time, I want to take you somewhere very different. We are leaving the cold stone cities of Switzerland and traveling east, far east, to the sun-baked plains of Anatolia in the 13th century, where a mystic was walking. Just walking, village to village, valley to valley, carrying nothing but his faith and a quality of presence that people found somehow impossible to ignore. His name was Haji Bektash Veli, and the tradition he planted, quietly, without armies, without the approval of any official religious authority, still lives in the hearts of millions of people today. People who have kept an inner flame burning through centuries of pressure, persecution, and the relentless demand to conform. I think you will find him familiar, in the best possible way. But for now, Conrad Grebel. A restless young man from a prominent family who should have had an easy life and chose a hard one instead, who watched a revolution calcify into a new establishment in real time and said, no, not this, not again, who drew a line between the authority of the state and the authority of conscience and held it at everything it cost him for 18 extraordinary months. He did not live to see what the line became. He did not live to see the traditions that grew from that cold room. The Mennonites, the Baptists, the Quakers, the long, patient tradition of non-resistant witness that would one day walk with Gandhi, sit with King, stand at the Edmund Pettus Bridge with nothing but moral clarity and an unwillingness to be moved. He was 28 years old. He was exhausted and sick, and he had been running for most of his adult life, and he was completely, utterly clear about what mattered. I have known a great many people across a very long life. Clarity like that, the kind that holds under pressure, that does not bend when the council rules against you, that looks at a wolf speaking the language of a sheep and calls it by its right name. That kind of clarity is rarer than genius. It is rarer than courage, even. It is, I think, what holiness actually looks like, not robes and incense and the approval of the powerful. Just a person who knows what is true and will not pretend otherwise, and pays the cost of that knowing with something very like grace. The thread holds, my friend. It has always held, even in the cold, even in the dark, even in the rooms the world would rather forget. Much love, I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this story meant something to you, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the next one. And if you'd like to help the Golden Thread reach further, leave us a 5-star review or share this episode with a friend. That's how these stories keep traveling, from heart to heart, across the world. Until next time, look for that golden thread in your life, my friend. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.